What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. Protests on campuses and the Googleplex. The big tech has fired 50 employees over sit-ins at the office. Journalist Joanne Littman says activism on the job has turned a corner.
In 2018, 2016, you had employees who were together, who were pushing together, unified against management for whatever reason. Today, you have employee against employee.
Also, at work, the Federal Trade Commission voting to ban non-compete contracts. The Verge's Alex Heath.
I haven't met anyone who likes a non-compete who isn't the one who's enforced it.
President Biden's student debt relief plan is under fire from a fellow Democrat. Economist Jason Furman makes his case.
What you need to do is target the people who have been the most unlucky or gone to colleges that really ripped them off. This is 30 million people. This is very, very broad. It's not very targeted.
All that today, plus Jamie Dimon on the economy and Facebook on your face, Meta's wearable assistant.
This is the future.
It's Wednesday, April 24th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And here we go this morning. Let's check things out.
Tensions are rising over protests on college campuses. House Speaker Mike Johnson announced a plan to visit Columbia University that will take place today to meet with Jewish students and discuss what he described as the troubling rise of virulent anti-Semitism on American college campuses. Meantime, late last night, Columbia's president providing an update saying the school is now in talks with student protesters to clear an encampment on its west lawn. It set a deadline of tonight to dismantle that encampment, or it will consider alternative options for clearing the area. The university president also saying the school will not tolerate intimidating, harassing, or discriminatory behavior, and it's working to identify protesters who violated those policies and will put them through, quote, appropriate disciplinary processes. So we will see, and I know there's a whole bunch of donors that are watching all of this, waiting to figure out whether this all goes in the
direction. Yeah, I spoke with a bunch of them yesterday, off the record on some of these things, but some of those major donors are just saying the president should have taken much stronger steps to begin with, kind of what Lee Cooperman told us yesterday on our air, waiting to see how this plays out. But if you look at this, these are college students who are graduating right now, who spent their first year remote because of COVID. So they didn't get to be on campus for that. And now you're talking about closing out that 4 years with not being able to potentially go to classes. And we'll see what happens to their graduation, too. Yeah.
And the masks, it's not that the Venn diagram shows that the protesters are also COVID fearmongers. They're wearing the masks, so wear the masks.
Oh, yeah, they're wearing the mask to cover up
their
identity.
They're wearing masks to show the
masks. What are you talking about?
I know, but I see masks now, and I figure, oh, my God. I mean, there's people all over the place still wearing masks, and they're not protesting.
No, there was Ackman was pointing out,
these people don't want to
change laws.
Take your mask off. If you're doing this, let us know who you are.
Ackman pointed out that New York changed laws during COVID to make it no longer a crime to be wearing a mask when you're doing some of these things.
Right.
Those were all COVID-era laws that changed.
I don't think you should, go to your bank teller with a hoodie and a mask, right?
No, it used to be.
And sunglasses?
At my
would you do
teller,
that?
They used to say no face coverings at all.
It
changed during COVID, but I also know the one that keeps getting hit.
The whole thing is, you saw yesterday, we talked about the president of Colombia, and it was 23 years ago, months after, and she, I don't know what her capacity was at that point, but she said that terrorism is a form of protest after 9/11, just months after 9/11. And she eventually ended up
running the place,
rising to the highest. But maybe that was could have been your first clue.
Part of what was taking place here is these aren't all students. Some of these are
I'm sure they're outside.
People.
There's always
so
outside agitators.
Anybody who's not a student
I am so not sympathetic to the argument. There's a lot of people out there who making this
that it's outside agitators.
They repeatedly are making this point that there's outside agitators. And people, that in every instance, there will always be outside agitators.
I'm not making an excuse for it, Andrew. My point is if they should kick them out, which is what they've said they're going to do.
Well, they should kick them out, but they also need to actually deal with the students. And by the way, the students are oftentimes letting in the agitators. So this idea that these agitators are somehow out there and are taking over the school is, I think, one of the great myths of this whole thing.
What year is it? And
they've allowed it to happen if it has happened. They haven't kicked them off campus.
The tent,
they haven't
done I think they're getting some funding
the
for
mayor,
the tent.
The mayor
I think the
is
tents
furious.
Are bought by someone.
The mayor is furious because they were throwing bottles and chairs at police officers who were there. That is not peaceful protest.
But you're right. And I know you don't like my old movie references, but The Graduate, the guy who's the landlord in The Graduate, accuses Dustin Hoffman, says, hey, you won them outside agitators.
Are you
one of the, you one of those, and
that
he gets mad and, you know, because the people are yelling at, you know, it's classic. But so that was 1967, probably. So there were outside agitators going all the way back to 1967.
The Federal Trade Commission has voted for a nationwide ban against non-compete agreements with companies used to prevent employees from taking jobs with competitors in the same industry. We talked about this with Lena Khan when she originally announced it. It is now here. The FTC is saying that non-competes impede the efficiency of the labor market and can lead to higher prices for consumers. If implemented, the rule would prohibit new non-compete clauses and strike down existing ones for all employees except senior executives. And senior executives are defined as the following. They need to earn $151,000 per year and are in policy making roles. I think there's going to be some questions about some of the people who make more than $150,000 who think they have policymaking roles or don't, but we'll see. The new rule is set to take effect in about 4 months, but business groups have said that they will challenge it because those clauses help preserve intellectual property and protect company secrets. It's going to have huge ripple effects throughout the economy, perhaps good and in some cases bad, and we will see what a whole bunch of folks say about it in a little bit.
They're situations that have been abused incredibly. If you look at hair salons, where basically at the moment you walk in the door, they say you can't work anywhere in a 30-mile radius. That seems ridiculous. It seems like those people have been completely held back. You can definitely see some situations where it's been abused. I don't know what the potential side effects that are unintended side effects that we could see down the road, but this is a situation.
I think if you look at the numbers, it should bring up, it should actually create real income for a lot of people who have been unable to leave some of their jobs and actually be able to get a raise and another job within their 30-mile radius, and so they don't have to move. By the way, we were talking just in the past couple of days,
secrets.
But also we were talking the other day about real estate and mobility and the inability to physically move because they're locked into mortgages. Well, this actually will be a real boost in the short term. So and maybe the long term. Having said that, I think the trade secret thing is actually a real issue. And I think they're going to have to try to figure out how to deal with that. I also think this $150,000 threshold is an interesting one. The addition of the policymaking piece, I think it's going to be an interesting definition because I know a lot of people who are paid more than $150,000 who don't think that they have policymaking roles. Maybe they will now, from a defined perspective, think they do. Oh, we make the policy literally as we speak.
I don't know if we feel very powerful. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, speaking yesterday at the Economic Club of New York, he talked a lot about what we've heard from him recently. He talked about his concerns. He talked about what a strong economy this has been. And then he brought up some ideas yesterday about what really concerns him about the economy in spite of that strong growth.
Part of the reason I think we've had this strong growth is the fiscal spending. You know, and why not spend another $2 trillion? And if we did, what would happen? You'll have more money, people would invest more money, people would hire more people, and you'd have more growth. But it's also quite inflationary, and so you have trade-offs there. So far, we're in pretty good shape, and so far, it looks like that soft landing type of scenario, but I'm putting me on the cautious side of that one. It's a great quote when I started working in Wall Street. I can't say it in its actual language, but it's something like, the markets will do whatever they have to do to hurt the most people.
I mean, that was his point, that things could turn at any point and that he thinks the market could be setting up for one of those scenarios when it confounds as many people as possible. He also weighed in on a lot of things, including politics, what's happening in Washington, and he weighed in about the rise of anti-capitalist sentiment in young people.
Which, you know, try to teach the younger people, if they like socialism so much, let them go to Cuba, Russia, or Venezuela, or Argentina, or all these other places, and let them learn the hard way what it's like, you know. So we can learn a lot from the rest of the world. We should also look at ourselves. I always look at, like, I'm not afraid of China. I'm afraid that we don't get our own act together.
Kind of played into some of the things that you're seeing play out on college campuses across. But Jamie has always talked about how he is a red-blooded American, defended the capitalist society very heavily. It was interesting. He was talking about New York and the economy here, and he said New York shouldn't take for granted its success. It should be more concerned about things like taxes, right, things like crime, housing policies. And he said he gets calls all the time from cities like a Memphis or a Dallas or an Austin, always wanting to say, what would it take to get you to come here? So he says he feels very welcome just about anywhere except for in Washington, D.C. He said that's the only place he feels like he gets treated like crap.
I thought that political stuff was interesting. He said whichever way it goes, you got to bring in people from the other party. But the thing that they need to have in common is they should be practitioners, which means people that know something about the private sector and how to do it. And then I tried to think of what that would look like if President Biden's reelected. Trying to think, I don't think he would ever do that. He wouldn't bring in any. And then I think if Trump were to win this time around, I don't think he might try to bring in Jamie Dimon. And then I wonder, is there any way Jamie Dimon would serve in the Trump administration? No way.
Well, he basically said he wouldn't go to Washington. He said he always wanted to be president, but he didn't think anybody was going to be anointing him anytime soon. He did say he thinks practitioners should go, and then he said, and by that I mean you all, not me. And he was being interviewed by Marie-Josée Kravis at the Economic Club. She's the former chairwoman of the Economic Club in New York.
Right.
Meta's CEO Mark Zuckerberg announcing an expansion of the company's line of Ray-Ban smart glasses. They're going to be offered in new styles to fit more faces and shapes and will feature new features, including updates to Meta's AI. Meta says the glasses can translate text from other languages in real time and use the AI assistant to answer questions or complete tasks hands-free. And I can tell you, as a beta user of these glasses, of the new features, they are pretty extraordinary. It is just beyond. I thought about bringing them today just so everybody could see, but I realized you couldn't.
But they look like real glasses.
No, you mean fashion-wise, they're beyond?
Well, no.
The way they
fashion-wise,
look
they're great glasses. They look like Ray-Ban wafer glasses.
Much better than any of them.
And they're very attractive. You would never know that they're technically anything.
But I mean, that's the changeover.
That's what's so great about them. But the best part is, first of all, putting aside the AI, you can be on the telephone and just listen. You don't, no headphones. You can listen to music if you'd like. Mm. But most importantly, you can now, because they have cameras in them, you can say, you know, I don't know, if something was broken in front of us, you could say, I need to fix this. How would I do it? And it will literally talk to you and say, well, you go to the left and you do this. Nope, don't do that. Do this. You could go traveling. You could say, what is this?
It could tell you
about a painting.
Your Apple goggles on over the glasses. And what would happen? Would you
nothing. You're not seeing anything through the glasses.
Yeah, but you can't put anything over it then. Could you, if you wanted to do that?
I don't know why you would.
I don't know. You love both products. I don't know what a guy like you does when you have so many beta products.
Great.
Is it?
This is the future. We'll all be wearing these things. And the coolest part, by the way, is you know how you've gone to cocktail parties and things, I'm sure, where you can't remember somebody's name, right? Yeah. This is not there yet.
That has been my
but
hope.
But I am pretty convinced that within the next 5 years, this thing will say, that's Becky Quick. And that's Joe Kernan.
No, you're going to look like an idiot standing in a party wearing sunglasses.
No, they haven't.
And everybody will know. Everybody will know that you don't remember and that you're getting help.
It will all
and
be
it
getting
won't
help.
Be any more
we'll
sincere.
Be help.
But
it's
it will
better
be
than
any
looking
more...
down at their name tag.
I hate that.
Well, the worst part is when they don't have a name tag.
Right.
And then you have to, you know, say, can I tell you something? I'm not going to say the name of the guy because it will just, the whole thing was so embarrassing.
Do.
I just had a meeting with him. A major CEO of a company.
Yeah.
I'm at He just reminded me.
I've done the same thing. I know what you're
doing. I'm at a thing in Davos, Switzerland, talking to the guy. He's very nice to me. I'm talking, and I say, he doesn't have a badge, or maybe he does, but I can't see the badge. I say, what do you do? I said, where do you work? He says this name of this company, and I don't know any better. So I say, and what do you do there? And he says, I'm the CEO, I run it, or something like that. And it was just, the whole thing was so embarrassing, because also we're in this profession, so we should know some of these things. The glasses would have helped me. That's my only point.
I've done worse. I have called people by the wrong name when I know who they are.
Right.
I know exactly who you are, and I've called you by the wrong name because you're in a meeting with, or in a conference with 50,
you know, we all have great stories about this.
I'm just saying.
There was once an anchor who turned to a guy on the left and said, who are you? And the guy said, hi, I'm Larry. And the anchor said, oh, yeah, Larry, what do you do? And he said, I'm Treasury Secretary.
Larry Summers. I remember that.
There was same guy was watching George W. Bush speak and said, there's another guy speaking before him. He said, I don't know who this guy is talking, but when he gets done, George Bush is King Abdullah. It was the
King of Jordan.
King of Jordan.
Yeah.
So, see, the glasses could be very helpful. That's the only point. They're not ready.
You
by
think
the way,
they would have? Yet, would that have helped? Would that have helped?
I don't know. I don't know.
Who was? Oh, you won't tell?
I'll tell you later.
Because you know everybody and you remember everybody.
I try.
Every once in a while.
This person was new to me.
How long
were a new CEO, by the way?
Oh, they were.
I've talked to people I know. Okay. Yeah. That's the
see,
worst.
So was it?
All right, we do. Your
Aaron Sorkin.
That's the better known Sorkin.
Is it Jonathan Sorkin?
I mean, you know, talk to Elon.
But for those people born before 1990, you remember Three's Company at least. Okay.
Da, 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 da.
Are you kidding me? John Ritter, the greatest.
I love John Ritter.
I went to the set of Three's Company as a child.
I loved him, too.
One of the greatest shows in history.
I loved him. Okay. Prior to Mr. Furley.
Yeah.
Who was Don Knotts, who is a classic himself, was Mr. Roper.
Oh.
Yep.
Who was Norman Fell,
who
was Dustin Hoffman's landlord, who accused him, are you one of them outside agitators up at, he's at Berkeley. He goes up to see Catherine Ross at Berkeley. Remember,
like
he chases
her.
Yeah. So that's who, anyway. Is that okay, Andrew? I mean, we used to do.
Now I'm going
to
be singing.
Some of our viewers. What's our average viewer age, would you say? We're working on it. We're trying to skew it a little bit. I'm not helping.
You're not helping.
No. Coming up, but we want to keep anybody.
Where the
kisses
are his and
yes, his and his.
Our Three's Company will be right back after this break with a look at culture in the office. Yale's Joanne Littman on how we talk to each other at work.
Even in the last 5 years, the cultural national dialogue has gotten way coarser, from everything from politics to Congress to public life to people like Elon Musk.
And Alex Heath from The Verge on politics pushing workers out of jobs.
I'm not sure we'd ever seen, especially since I've been covering tech for the last decade or so, an example of that many firings at once.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is Squawk Pod.
Welcome back to Squawk Box. Google has now fired 50 employees it said were involved in protests at company offices over a cloud computing deal with Israel. joining us right now on that and the FTC's new ban on non-compete clauses. Alex Heath, he's the deputy editor for The Verge and author of the Command Line newsletter. Also, Joanne Lippman is here this morning at the table, lecturer at Yale University and a CNBC contributor. Good morning to both of you. Alex, I think you've woken up super early because I think you're on the West Coast this morning. So let's just talk Google. And I'm curious what you make of what's happened there, but also what you make of happening in terms of the culture in the Valley right now, going from this sort of open campus university model, say what you want, what you will, to what looks like a bigger clampdown.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just hit it on the head. I think Google personifies this culture shift that's happening across tech and really across corporate America, but especially in tech. With Google in particular, you've got a company where senior executives were on stage almost in tears in 2016 after Trump got elected, talking about that and the implications of that. And fast forward to, this last week, you've got Sundar Pichai sending an email to all employees saying, hey, we don't want politics in the workplace. And this was right after they'd confirmed that they'd fired 28 employees, which for Google is unique, but also for the tech industry at large. I'm not sure we'd ever seen, especially since right. I've been covering tech for the last decade or so, an example of that many firings
Alex,
at once.
Here's the thing that I think we're all trying to understand is, you know, when some of this began back in 16 and some of the protests in 18 and even in 20, there was and it felt like the employees were running the place, right? You know, the inmates were running the asylum to some degree. And there was a view, I think, among management that they couldn't clamp down on this, even if they wanted to, because these engineers and their employees were so important. And that if, in fact, they actually did anything about these things, that they would have a bigger problem, that the labor market was so tight that these people would race off to other jobs. Calculus today versus the calculus then?
I mean, I think you've seen a lot of power shift from the rank and file back to the company. And what was unusual about this protest is that it was a sit-in protest. So there were people physically impeding others and standing in the offices of the CEO of Google Cloud, for example. That is really taking things to a new level. Google is no stranger to protests, but I think they saw this as an opportunity to really put a flag down and say, look, we're not going to tolerate this kind of behavior.
Okay, so,
and then they ended up firing an additional 20.
So, Joanne, are you then of the view that this was just so egregious, but it's not really a cultural shift? Meaning the protests of old, which might not have actually happened literally in the physical office of the CEO of a division, those protests will be okay tomorrow, but these protests won't, or think this is a new paradigm?
I do think it's a new paradigm. We are seeing a cultural shift. I think about, you know, it just so happened coincidentally in 2018, there was a huge walkout. It was about workplace culture. It was about sexual harassment. It was November 2018. I happened to be at the Googleplex, Google headquarters, to give a talk that day. So I was in the midst of this. And it was supported by the company. It was huge, but it was peaceful. And it almost felt like a party, right? And you had this environment versus where you are today. And I think there's a couple of major differences that have happened. You know, one is employers have been trying to pull back ever since, you know, the pandemic, where employees all got the power. They're trying to pull some of that back. But there are a couple of real differences. And the hugest one, I think, is that in those 2018, 2016, you had employees who were together, who were pushing together, unified against management for whatever reason. Today, you have employee against employee.
So it's much more splintered.
Much more splintered. And also, you have employees who are saying, I'm feeling unsafe. And you're in an environment with Hamas and Israel, where you've got an increase in anti-Semitic incidents and anti-Muslim incidents. So it's a different environment. And the one other thing I just want to point out is, even in the last 5 years, the dialogue, the cultural national dialogue has gotten way coarser, from everything from politics to Congress to public life to people like Elon Musk, who are now out there, who are sort of, you know, ginning up sort of a really kind of vitriolic dialogue.
Alex, I want to talk about this FTC decision and how it's going to change things. California, by the way, has always been a state, or at least more recently has been a state, where these non-competes are not always enforceable. Is this going to change the dynamic there? Or are we just talking about a different kind of worker? $150,000 seems to be the threshold for preventing non-competes in the future. But you do have to have some kind of policy-oriented role that could be potentially a little fuzzy and fungible.
You know, Andrew, I haven't really seen a ton of high profile examples of tech companies enforcing these non-competes. You've seen Amazon do it selectively. There was an example with, I believe, an executive who went to Google Cloud in the last few years where they tried to enforce a non-compete because he was coming from Seattle. But yeah, you're right. California hasn't had this. The California tech industry is the best tech industry and one of the best industries in the world. I haven't met anyone who likes a non-compete who isn't the one who's enforced it. So I think this is generally good. There's been a kind of chilling effect generally. But as it relates specifically to tech, I haven't seen a ton of examples of this actually being forced. I think it's more that kind of unspoken chilling effect.
Joanne, we got to go, so we only got 20 seconds. A good thing or a bad thing long-term for labor?
Oh, very much a good thing.
And if you were a CEO, you go to court over this or no?
I think they will go to court over this. I don't know that they'll win. I think the question is, does the FTC actually have the mandate? Do they have the power to put this into place? And I don't, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
Joanne, thank you. Alex, thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up next on Squawk Pod, one Democratic economist is making his case against President Biden's student debt relief plan. Jason Furman.
The goal of this is to raise consumption. In fact, I've seen analysis of proponents of it saying this will increase consumption. Well, consumption right now is really, really strong. You make it stronger, and that's what puts upward pressure on interest rates.
Plus, just how much are we getting done in America? Productivity data. More fun than it sounds with CNBC's Steve Leisman.
For the Fed, higher productivity could mean lower for longer. It's like adding factories and workers without really adding either. But getting there could be tricky.
We'll be right back.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate. Pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
You're listening to Squawk Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
Stand by, Joe. Here's Mike. Cue.
Fed officials and Wall Street economists are engaged in a critical debate over the recent boom in productivity and whether it's here to stay. The answer could impact everything from inflation and that outlook to interest rates to how we all live in the future. You finally decided to delve into this. Senior economics reporter Steve Leisman.
It's a big deal.
Joins us with what
I wish I had better answers, but I think I have good stuff on the debate.
We've obliquely been mentioning it a lot lately.
You know, that's the end of my story. I want to talk about what y'all are doing about this, but let me do the story first.
We're not helping productivity.
Then I'm going to compliment you, actually, Joe. Maybe not you, but no, I'm going to compliment.
Okay.
I'll get there. But hold on, folks. When the GDP number comes out tomorrow, Wall Street's going to pore over the spending and the inflation details, looking for the clues about the economy. But what it won't see is maybe the most important number of all, the underlying productivity data for the economy. The growth in the economy's efficiency is often the biggest part of growth, and it has been booming. Take a look at this data here. For the 5 years before the pandemic, it grew at a trend like 1.4%. From the beginning of the pandemic through the first quarter of last year, it dropped to 1.3%. You had a huge surge at the beginning, followed by a really worrying decline. People thought we're in this downtrend. But the past three quarters, off the charts, 3.7%, which is double or more the long-run average here. The boom has launched a debate among Fed officials and economists, taking place alongside, and importantly alongside, the inflation debate about whether it's real or just a blip. The consequences, as Austin Goolsbee said last week, are far-reaching.
That's fundamentally going to change everything about the economy, in a way. And it would have direct implications for monetary policy. It would put us back in an environment that would very much be like the late 90s, where you could have faster wage growth without inflation. You could have faster GDP growth.
All right, here's what the skeptics are saying. It's all noise because they really like to look at productivity over a five-year span. There's work from home, and they think that might be distorting it, where people aren't really reporting the hours worked. They're being mismeasured, and of course, they say it's too soon to tell. Optimists are saying work from home is a source of greater efficiency. With better matching of employees with jobs, companies are learning to do more with less in the inflation fight during the pandemic, and the higher growth in inflation has led to that higher productivity, mother being the necessity of invention. For the Fed, higher productivity could mean lower for longer. because it's like a long-term positive supply shock. It's like adding factories and workers without really adding either. But getting there could be tricky. It could mean more demand for capital, which could mean higher for a shorter time until the positive effects take hold. Guys, what I wanted to say at the beginning here was I'm watching every single interview you're doing about AI and with company CEOs as part of the reporting of this story. Because remember, we're not looking for productivity growth. We get that. 1.5% is about what we do. We need to know if the growth rate is increasing. So think about, like, I don't know, a PC or a chip, right? Which grows, the speed increases 1.5% a year. If it grows by 15%, well, what is that? That's like 10 years of improvement in a single year. So what we want to know is the rate of productivity or efficiency increasing? That's what changes everything.
Can I just add, Jamie Dimon, we were talking about his comments at the Club of New York earlier. Okay, he did talk about AI. He said that they have 400 uses for it already. He rattled off things like risk, fraud, marketing, idea generating, that they're already using AI. It's already embedded into that stuff. They have taken... they took a woman and put her in charge of all AI, and she directly reports to Jamie Dimon. And I think companies taking and doing things like that are going to start, you know, super hyping up the actual.
I don't think it's here yet. I think it's like the.
I don't think AI is part of this at all yet. That's my opinion.
No. You know the only place?
Right.
College students have more time because they don't have to
write
anything.
They don't have to write any papers. Absolutely.
It's not just. Tell me about this whiz-bangery technology. Tell me what it's used for and how it's going to work its way into the economy and how we live.
I can tell you how you're going to use it. I mean, JP Morgan is using it to some degree, but I don't think it's taking jobs away just yet. But we've talked about actually in finance, anybody or in marketing or anybody who's making a deck, you know, a PowerPoint presentation.
For a merger and acquisition,
For any kind of time you're going to make a presentation.
Marketing, I think, is a big part.
To anybody. You know, if you're a marketing company that has to try to come up with different advertising or pitching different things, all of those, all the time that's wasted taking your idea in your brain and trying to put it on paper and make it look great, that's where today the time can actually be compressed.
And that's the argument for not being as mad as I am about college students using this. They have to figure out how to use the AI tools because
and then
it's
maybe they want to do something else. Yeah.
Instead of paying my roommate to write the.
The Biden administration published its new student loan forgiveness proposal following an earlier Supreme Court rejection on their first round attempt. Our next guest says that the plan is poorly targeted and will make inflation worse. Joining us right now is former Council of Economic Advisors Chairman Jason Furman. He's an economics professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Jason, we should probably point out you were in your position in a Democratic administration. So you are speaking out against what a Democratic administration is proposing to do right now. What are your problems with it?
Look, we have unsustainable debt. We have high mortgage rates. We have an economy that has not landed softly. This is a plan that we've only heard estimates for part of the cost of it. But when you take the plan as a whole, it's likely to be $250 to $750 billion. Is that a quantitatively huge contributor to the problems I cited? No. Is it moving in the wrong direction on all of them? Yes, it is. And we shouldn't be doing that right now.
I have seen arguments out there that say, hey, what are you talking about that this costs anybody any money? All it is we just say, poof, it goes away. Nobody has to pay this and it doesn't result in anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's like all sorts of magic fairy dust, pixie dust arguments out there. They're not arguments that would get anyone a passing grade in my classroom. The goal of this is to raise consumption. In fact, I've seen analysis of proponents of it saying this will increase consumption. Well, consumption right now is really, really strong. You make it stronger, and that's what puts upward pressure on interest rates, upward pressure on inflation. And of course, this gets recorded as an increase in spending and ultimately a higher path for the debt.
There is a problem with the cost of college these days and having students who get out with $100,000, $150,000, $250,000 in debt is a serious issue. How should we be addressing this?
Look, I think there's a serious issue there. If you look at where the defaults are, they tend to be people with actually lower amounts of debt, a couple thousand dollars. They can have defaults that stay with them for their life. So you have the administration that already did an income-driven repayment program, people with low incomes that were struggling to pay back the debt. This is on top of that. So I think what you need to do is target the people who have been the most unlucky or gone to colleges that really ripped them off. This is 30 million people. This is very, very broad. It's not very targeted. That's what I see the issue is. And finally, you know, I probably would rather have Congress weigh in on issue this big.
Yeah. You got, Jason, other issues maybe with some, I'm going to bring up this capital gains proposal, and I haven't talked to you. I don't know whether you think 44.6 is too high, but I have heard anecdotally that not everybody from President Obama's administration is pleased with some of the stuff that's happening now in the Biden administration. Is there any scenario where you would think that would be the highest rate since its creation in 1922, capital gains? Do you think that would hurt capital development or deployment at 44.6%? Is that a good number for you?
Look, I like the president's budget. We have a lot of problems in our fiscal situation. If you passed his budget in its entirety, we'd be on a path of less debt than the path we're on now. You have to make tough choices on taxes. Look, the best tax system, if we didn't have any needs in our country, would be to not collect taxes from anyone. Every way of collecting taxes has some downside or trade-off. But overall, I think they have a broadly responsible budget, and I'm quite enthusiastic about it. Sorry to disappoint you, Joe.
That Jason disappoints me greatly.
We were, Jason, we were batting around the non-compete news this morning out of the FTC and the impact on labor, employment, and potentially wages longer term. Lena Khan saying this is going to create billions of dollars in new wages. Do you think that's the case?
Look, I like the idea of banning non-competes for many classes of workers. I wish they'd built some exceptions in. Higher paid workers are sophisticated enough to understand these agreements. There's a legitimate purpose for them. But I think this probably will improve bargaining power for lower wage workers. And I'm enthusiastic about that part of it. As opposed to the FTC's specific estimates, I don't know, because you do need to take into account, for example, that sometimes you actually have to compensate people more in exchange for a non-compete and work out those types of dynamics as well. But step in the right direction maybe goes a bit, overshoots that right direction a bit.
Jason, you know, I've now quoted you a bunch of times on the air in the past week because you tweeted out, I think about a week or two ago now, that if in fact the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, I think you were suggesting in this calendar year, you thought it would be a function not of inflation going down, but actually of an employment problem in this country.
You mean cutting rates?
Cutting rates.
Oh, you said raise it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Cutting rates. And I thought that was a very sort of provocative view, and whether you think that actually will come true.
Yeah, look, I mean, you have the sort of monkey's paw wish situation here. There's all sorts of people wishing for a rate cut. If that wish gets delivered, it may get delivered because the employment situation deteriorated. I think a cut in December would be possible based on lower inflation. But before then, you've had a Fed that's been repeatedly burned by thinking inflation had come down and it reasserts itself. I don't think you're going to be able to have 1, 2, or 3 months of low inflation that are reassuring after the 3 really high months we just had. So I don't think there's going to be enough time to build enough confidence that inflation has come down to justify lower rates. I'm not predicting a downturn in the economy, but the economy can turn on a dime. And if that happens, then I think the Fed could be there to help rescue it.
Or if something breaks, not just the economy, but if something breaks in the economy beyond just the jobs.
Since the H word came up, Harvard, I can't remember, are you across the river or are you in Cambridge?
I'm in Cambridge.
Kennedy's in Cambridge, I think. So,
I have an office in the economics department, too. So
something's happening in the yard. I can't remember what it was. You're not allowed
yesterday,
to
yesterday, there was like huge gatherings of students playing spike ball and frisbee when I was walking through the yard.
But I know that there's some concern up there as well. And here we go again, Jason. And I just wonder at this point, I don't know why it's happening, how it's happening, but it seems like there's kind of an epidemic among college presidents of a groupthink about I don't know, Palestine, anti-Semitism, and however you, do you regret sticking your neck out for Claudine Gay at the time when that happened, Jason? In hindsight now, don't you think there is a serious issue at the top of these Ivy League schools?
Look, I think she certainly made mistakes. I didn't defend her on the plagiarism set of issues, which I think raised real issues for her as president of Harvard. In terms of her testimony at the time, she did a bad job. All three of them did a bad job. I'm positive she's not remotely anti-Semitic. I think she did a lot of things right in a difficult situation. I think it would have been a mistake to push her out of Harvard over what happened in those hearings. And look, right now, most of our students are focused on learning, they're focused on studying, and they're focused on playing spike ball. We have students with real strong passions. That's a fine thing too. There's ways you can express those passions and ways you're not allowed to express those passions. But a healthy debate following a set of time, place, and manner rules on speech is what we should be aiming for and what, for the most part, we have, not completely, of course.
Hey, Jason, very quickly, I don't know if you heard our conversation with Steve Leisman right before, talking about productivity gains, whether you think this is the beginning of a longer-term trend, what we've seen over the last 3 months, or if you think that this is a temporary thing that's pushed up by something like additional spending from the government. What are your thoughts?
Look, I think there's a real possibility of a productivity revival in this country. I think if it happens, it'll be more like on a 2 to 10 year time horizon. So it won't be relevant and helpful for the Fed and what it's facing right now. The data of the last 3 months is pure noise. You measure productivity over the last 2 years and it's up 0.2%. You measure it over the last 5 years, it's up less than had been forecast prior to the pandemic. So I don't, that what we're seeing in the data is just noise and post-pandemic gyrations. What we're seeing when we read about what's happening in AI, the developments in company, the developments in the technology, I think that's real. It's just not in the data yet. It's not in the economy yet in a huge way. I think it will be, just not here to rescue us from this landing issue we're facing now.
Jason, thank you for coming to play and taking any range of questions from us. It's always great talking to you.
Great talking to you.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern and get the very best from our TV show. The interviews, the headlines, the jokes, right in your ears when you follow Squawk Pod, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.